From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's a time of social ferment in and out of the food world, but the food world always responds. As I'm moving through this extraordinary period of time, more and more I'm thinking of it as two pandemics, one new and one as old as time, COVID-19 and racism. For many of us, food is comfort, a balm, but food can also be a weapon. Adrian Miller is a historian and author who acknowledges both, but he believes that food has the ability to reconcile.
When you sit down at a table with someone, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival.
Adrian goes by the moniker Soul Food Scholar. He was the deputy director of President Clinton's Initiative for One America. Now he focuses on the intersection of faith and food. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, good to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you. You call yourself a recovering lawyer and politico. The Initiative for One America, of which you were the deputy director during the Clinton time, what work did it focus on?
So it focused on racial, ethnic, and religious reconciliation. And the underpinning of it was the wild and crazy idea that if we just sat down and talked to one another and listened, we might realize that we have a lot more in common than what supposedly divides us.
And what years were you doing this work?
So I was there from 1999 to 2001. So I was at the very end of President Clinton's second term.
Do you think this moment is substantively different to affect another stab at moving the needle?
I think it is different because there have been times before where I thought we would be in this moment, really 5 years ago with the murders of the Bible study group at the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. I thought that was going to be a triggering event, kind of like the bombing of the Birmingham church that killed the four little girls in the early 1960s, how that further galvanized the civil rights movement. Anecdotally, I can just tell you, it seems like more white people are paying attention, want to learn and want to engage on the issue. I just haven't seen this level of concern and wanting to do something before.
You know, so often on this show and in the media in general, we talk about food as a way to bring us together over the table. But so often that just feels completely ingenuous. There's a flip side. Food can just as easily be weaponized to tear us apart, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we have a deep history of that in this country. And I think it happens around the world as well. But I think particularly of the way food was weaponized against African Americans in the late 1800s. Stereotypes of African Americans in certain foods had certainly been floating around in our culture. But at a moment when African Americans had a modicum of civil and social and political rights, there was a propaganda campaign by cultural tastemakers that basically used food to make African Americans seem weird or childlike or even bestial. And the idea was like, look, you gave these people these rights. They don't really deserve them. Here's why. And it wasn't just in the South. Editors and people outside the South were happy to recycle these harmful images. And the most toxic were fried chicken and watermelon. And the goofiest thing about that, two things, is one, watermelon and fried chicken are delicious. And two, white people were eating those same foods. But it just shows you the power dynamic, how the stigma could be attached to African Americans. So much so that even today, I know people who are reluctant to eat fried chicken and watermelon around whites, and at least be photographed or filmed doing it.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And angering. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben being shown the door.
Yes. So I think it's long overdue. And I think it's really interesting to see the reaction, both from African-Americans and whites about this, believing that these food figures are being erased, but they don't know the history. Aunt Jemima, Faustus for Cream of Wheat, and Uncle Ben, they go back to a time where society said black people had a certain role, and your role was servitude. And so you were supposed to be the happy servant and meet all the needs of whites. And so those are that's the background. That's the history, the roots of those images. Now, that history has not been passed on. So now we have people reacting to the removal in kind of very interesting and shocked ways, but they just don't know that history and what messaging those images sent, especially to African Americans.
I know that you're working on an upcoming book on barbecue called Black Smoke. Has barbecue also been weaponized?
Yeah, so we focus kind of on fried chicken and watermelon, but barbecue was on the list of foods that essentially were used as fodder for creating caricatures of African Americans. Really racist stuff. And so 100 years ago, Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville, which were kind of entertainment circles in our society, there were things called like the Dark Town Barbecue. And you would see just kind of coon images of African Americans. And you see this not only in kind of literature and art and music, but you see it in film. There's several films that talk about African American barbecues, the spectacle of it. But again, it was the idea to show that African Americans were somehow weird. And at the same time, showing them as servants, because the idea was that Black people existed to make the very best barbecue. So 100 years ago, if you were thinking about the standard bearers for barbecue, it was African Americans.
So let's talk about your book, Black Smoke, in a bit more detail. Is it strictly history?
It starts out with the premise that, hey, African Americans have long been the standard bearers for excellent barbecue. Not the only ones. Of course, other people cooked barbecue, but people equated great barbecue with African Americans. And so it's really weird to be in this present time where in the media, very few African American barbecuers get love. So the idea is to go back to the roots and kind of trace the history and just make the case for why African Americans deserve much more attention and credit when you're talking about barbecue in this country.
So I'm sure that one part of this kind of research is eating, but what else does it involve?
Is there anything else that should be involved? No, I'm just kidding. So, yeah, so part of it was going through those oral histories of enslaved people and just seeing how barbecue evolved in the antebellum period. And why were enslaved African Americans the ones forced to make barbecue? And before that, it was enslaved Native Americans. So it was parsing that. And then just reading old digitized newspapers and magazines, because those media platforms were really about capturing daily life in the life of a community. And in a lot of those publications, they talked about these African Americans. Now, it wasn't until the late 1800s that they started to actually give these barbecuers name. But by the late 1800s, they named them, they kind of interviewed them and asked them for their techniques and secrets. And that's just the level of recognition that you don't see in other aspects of cooking around that time. So barbecue had a certain reverence attached to it.
Currently, you're the executive director of the Colorado Council of Churches. You're the first African-American and the first lay person to hold that position. The mission of the group is to walk together in faith, work together for justice. Where does food justice come into your work there?
So it's been really interesting. There's been a real awakening within Christian circles about dealing with issues of food justice, because for the longest time, churches have definitely responded in terms of charity. We have food banks, you know, pantries. When an emergency happens, we show up. But there's more thinking about, okay, why are people constantly hungry? Why is food insecurity such a persistent problem? And that means changing the system, and that means questions of justice. So what you're starting to see are more churches using their vast acreage of land to actually have community gardens, to teach people how to farm on their own property. So we're seeing a lot of interesting things there. We're seeing more people try to use food as a tool of reconciliation. One of the best events that we had at the Council of Churches is a couple years ago, and this was right after the murders of the Bible study group in Charleston, South Carolina. By chance, we were already working on this, but we had a big potluck. And we just said, bring food from your tradition, sit down at the table and just talk to somebody you don't know, and then see if there's ways that your churches can do work together to build fellowship. And the idea was to pair Black and white churches. And it was interesting because, you know, some people showed up with vegan soul food. So I had to say a quick prayer, but it was very good. In fact, vegan is one of the hottest trends in soul food. But I have to tell you, before that event, there was a lot of cynicism from Black pastors. They just did not think that white churches really wanted to do the lengthy and hard work of reconciliation And a few churches did enter those partnerships. But sure enough, after a few weeks, one of the white pastors told me, yeah, my congregants are kind of wondering why we keep doing this. And that just reinforced what the black pastors thought.
Well, we have to hope for this moment to deepen and stay.
Amen.
Why do you think that food creates a moment for us to come together? And what do you think the meaning is of that?
Well, I think in this time, because we have so few spaces now where we can come together and in so few ways to come together, I think food is one of those that can work, because we all have to eat. And when you sit down at a table with someone, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival. They're saying that they love you in a way. I mean, even if the food is straight nasty, right? The act of cooking is showing some love. And what I've found in my work with the Clinton White House and other arenas is that when there are race dialogues, if it's just about coming together to talk about race, they usually dissipate after several meetings because they just lose steam for whatever reason. But whenever the race dialogue is tied to some other activity that brings people enjoyment and gives people a chance to get to know each other and build relationship, those seem to have more staying power. So I think food allows us to kind of relax, maybe put our guard down a little bit, explore another culture, and start to get to know people and build relationships that can be the foundation for then talking about the really tough things.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you.
That was historian and author Adrian Miller, a.k.a. Soul Food Scholar. He's the author of 2 award-winning books and is currently writing Black Smoke, African-American Adventures in Barbecue. Coming up, baba ganoush, bright, zingy herb salads, and talk of politics on the side. Sammy Tamimi, the famed chef partner in the Ottolenghi Empire, stops by to talk about his latest book, Falestine.